leader!
Hello, I'm Rhys Lyon, bringing you the Week in Parliament with Tom Frewen.
Parliament's been adjourned this week, back on Tuesday at 2 p.m. The only activity in the House involving MPs was in Committee Room Number 2 on Thursday, when the Finance and Expenditure Committee met to hear the Reserve Bank Governor's monetary policy statement for June. Effectively, that's an update on the setting of the bank's base interest rate, known as the official cash rate, which the Governor, Graham Wheeler, announced earlier on Thursday he was dropping by a quarter of a percentage point, from 3.5% to 3.25%. The reason for this decision was the subject of this question from the committee's chairman and National's Hamilton East MP, David Bennett.
Governor, you've been very good in the past of signalling changes that you may have, and today's probably come as somewhat of a surprise to some people that hadn't been signalled in advance. Has there been any change in circumstances in recent months that have caused you to come to this conclusion today?
I don't think anyone in the markets was surprised that we produced a set of interest rate projections that involve a decline in the 90-day track. So I don't think anyone was out there saying, gee, we think the Reserve Bank will produce a set of forward projections that are unchanged from March. And the market had built in a 50 basis point cut over the next 12 months, and that's what our projections build in as well. So the issue was always going to be, when will that process start and how much will the Reserve Bank lower its track by? So that's where the uncertainty was.
The last adjustment to the official cash rate was last July, when it was raised by the same amount as it went down on Thursday, prompting this question from Labor's finance spokesman, Grant Robertson.
I have to ask this, but do you think you got it wrong when you put it up last time?
No, I don't think so. And we've obviously given quite a lot of thought to that. But look, you know, when we started to raise rates last year, which was in March, and we did it March to July, the terms of trade for New Zealand were at a 40-year high. Migration was increasing. House prices were starting to rise, not just in Auckland but in other parts of the country. And like a lot of other forecasters, we were anticipating that there would be an output gap that would be building up and would create inflationary pressures. What we didn't foresee, but I don't think any forecasters did, was that the price of oil would decline over 55% from June, and that dairy prices would fall 55%.
Grant Robertson then set out to probe the difference between Mr. Wheeler's analysts and the Reserve Bank and their counterparts across the terrace and the Treasury.
I mean, I guess on the dairy price end of things, I mean, there have been projections about global supply being, you know, outstripping demand for some time. And I think, you know, I mean, your forecast looking forward now effectively take that into account, whereas, you know, the government's books don't at the moment. And that's, as I said, is the gap that's now being created between your projections and Treasury's projections.
Yeah, there is a difference between us on the current account deficit, between the Treasury and ourselves. They have a smaller current account deficit than we do.
And that is about their overly, in your view, clearly optimistic view of the dairy rebound.
But Graham Wheeler wasn't going there.
Well, I'm not sure I'd get into those sorts of terms. I wouldn't use them. But it's just different scenarios about what the terms of trade might be doing.
The Reserve Bank Governor explained more about the intricacies of monetary policy setting in answer to this question from the Greens finance spokesman, Russell Norman.
In the past, what we did with the Reserve Bank of New Zealand is we said, don't worry about output or GDP, just focus on inflation. And we didn't even think much about financial stability. It wasn't really even discussed very much in the past because we didn't really think it was a big problem. It was all about inflation. Whereas now you've got these two things that you're trying to deal with. And I was trying to get at this last time we had this meeting, which is, do you weigh them up one against each other each time you do one of these things, or do you separate them in your mind? Because you know, you're doing monetary policy statements one month, and then the other quarter or whatever, you're doing financial stability reports. And it's like, when you're doing each of those things, are you thinking about the other, and are you trying to kind of compromise, or are you doing two independent functions, which you view yourselves as kind of, you've got to make two independent decisions, kind of unrelated? Because it goes to the heart of whether one regulator should be doing both of these functions, if you like.
No,
Is that a fair question?
It's a very good question, and we think about a lot of things about policies in terms of assignment issues. What's the objective of the policy, and what's the appropriate target? And to give an example, I mean, you know, if we're thinking about financial stability issues. We will think, in the case of the Auckland housing market, we'll think about the supply and demand side factors that are driving that market. We'll think about what is it that we can do, given our regulatory authorities and given our instruments, monetary policy instruments, how could we, you know, try and generate an outcome that would help in respect of financial stability. It would mainly be through the macroprudential side. Hopefully, monetary policy can support the macroprudential and vice versa. But there will be situations where there may be a potential conflict.
Well, like today's decision is potentially a conflict. Right?
Well, in respect of Auckland, you know, you'll probably see banks throughout the country lower their floating rate mortgages and maybe a little bit, maybe just a little bit on their fixed rate mortgages. But, you know, for the country outside of Auckland, house price inflation is running at around 3% on average. So the issue is what are the supply and demand dynamics around Auckland? Another thing we think a lot about is what's happening to the general state of the economy, for example. We don't just sort of say, well, inflation's low, therefore let's cut interest rates. We also think very carefully about what is the supply side capacity of the economy, what's happening to demand, what's happening to unemployment and employment growth. So we've got an interesting position right now, in essence. You know, you've seen a lot of factor accumulation take place in the economy, right? You've seen the labour supply increase by something like 3.25%. So it's very rapid. Now, half of that's been migration, about a quarter of it's labour force participation, like we just talked about, and some of it's natural increase. But that, plus along with the capital formation that we've seen through high investment, some of it Canterbury, some of it Auckland, has built up the supply side capacity of the economy, so that it means that it can accommodate the demand growth in the economy without inflation pressures. So let me put it this way. If the labour force is increasing, say, 3.25%, employment's increased also roughly 3.25%, we haven't seen wage inflation start to accelerate. If we hadn't have seen that supply increase and we'd had that, you know, we hadn't had the strong migration, the strong labour force growth, and we'd had the strong employment growth, we would have seen stronger wage inflation.
Reserve Bank Governor Graham Wheeler at Thursday's meeting of the Finance and Expenditure Committee. Also in the news lately, the euthanasia debate, revived by a High Court decision that firmly placed responsibility for finding a resolution on Parliament, which will soon be confronted with a petition on the issue. It will be presented by Labour's Palmerston North MP, Ian Lees-Galloway, who spoke to Rhys Lyon this week by phone.
What the petition's basically calling for is for Parliament to have a look at what the public's perception is of end-of-life choice issues, and we see that as an opportunity actually to trigger an inquiry at Select Committee to consider all the issues around end-of-life choice, so that Parliament might be able to reach some form of consensus around what the way forward is and hopefully make some recommendations to government.
You've had a bit of history on this issue. Marianne Street had a members bill in the ballot on this, and you adopted it and it was withdrawn before the election. Did you suggest putting forward the petition?
No. The people who are supporting end-of-life choice out in the public did this off their own bat. To a certain extent, it was in response to the fact that there wasn't going to be a bill in the ballot, but I actually think this is a better way forward because, as we both know, the private members' bill system being the way it is, bills can sit in the ballot for a very long time and you're at the mercy of the lottery as to whether or not it comes out. This approach actually gives Parliament an opportunity to address the issue in the short term and have the debate at select committee that we haven't been able to have in either of the previous two attempts to get a bill up on this issue.
Sure, and that kind of answered my next question, which was, do you agree that the petition is a better way forward than putting forward a members' bill?
I think it is because whatever you put in a bill, I mean, there's a variety of ways that this issue has been addressed overseas, and so whatever you put in a bill is going to just be one of those, and a bill is necessarily going to be drafted without broad consultation with other members of Parliament. By taking it to select committee, having an open process where people who are both for and against end-of-life choice can come and have their voices heard, where we can look at the evidence that's available and we can look at the different ways that end-of-life choice regimes have been implemented around the world, we can then write up a report that everybody can consider and hopefully get some draft legislation out of that report. That's a much more robust way of putting together a bill than simply an individual member putting something up and then hoping that they can get it through first reading. I think a bill that's based on that consultative approach has a far better chance of making it through first reading and progressing through Parliament.
And would you be looking to present the petition, and when might that be?
Yeah, I've offered to table the petition. The final date for gathering signatures is the 20th, which is this weekend. And then as soon as we can arrange to table it in Parliament, I've offered to do that.
And John Key indicated he would have no problem with it going to the Justice and Electoral Committee. Yep. Just on a procedural note, can he influence which committee it goes to, or is that solely in the clerk's hands?
Well, that is really solely in the clerk's hands, and the clerk will have a decision to make. I think you could make an argument for it going to either Justice and Electoral or to Health. I understand that the people who are presenting the petition have a view that it should go to the Health Committee, but I think either of those two would be appropriate places for it to be considered.
And with it being generally agreed that it's a conscience issue, do you think committee members would have personal votes, or would it be along party lines?
That's a really interesting question each party will have to address. You could make an argument for it being a conscience vote, and I suspect that on both of those committees there are members who will have strong views about it and will want to be able to use their conscience vote at select committee. But that's a matter that each party will have to decide on its own about how its members vote at when it comes to making that decision.
Say it does go to the committee, what can a committee recommend at the end of the inquiry process?
Oh, look, a committee can recommend all sorts of things, and certainly it can recommend that the government adopt legislation. I would actually be interested to see if a select committee can in fact draft legislation and recommend that legislation to government. I'm not sure if that's possible, but certainly the select committee can write a comprehensive report based on what it has heard, and it can make recommendations to government, and government then has to respond to those recommendations. So there's certainly an opportunity for the select committee to be able to demonstrate to the government that Parliament has considered the issue and potentially can reach some consensus around it.
Does the number of signatures make any difference?
Look, I think it does. In terms of mounting a convincing argument that the select committee should seriously scrutinise the issues raised in the petition. But look, I think in this case, this is something which is clearly of significant public interest, and there is clearly a mood in the public that whichever side of the debate you're on, this is something that Parliament needs to address. And needs to give people the opportunity to have that open public debate about the issues. So I think regardless of the number of signatures, although I understand that there will be in excess of 3,000, that this is an issue of significance that the public wants Parliament to address properly.
Labour's Palmerston North MP, Ian Lees-Galloway. When Parliament resumed after the week-long adjournment, MPs debated a motion celebrating the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta.
Point of order, David Seymour.
Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to move a motion without notice to mark the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta.
Can I just clarify for the member this is a debatable motion that the member's proposing?
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
I will put the leave. Is there any objection to that course of action being followed? There is none. David Seymour.
Mr. Speaker, I move that this House note the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta, a document which Lord Denning described as, quote, the greatest constitutional document of all times, the foundation of the freedom of the individual against the arbitrary authority of the despot, end quote, and which established the notion that the law is not simply the whim of the king or of government, and that all are equal under the law and can be held to account, and thus that the Magna Carta represents the foundation of the rights and freedoms which we enjoy today. Mr. Speaker, this month...
The motion be agreed to, David Seymour.
Mr. Speaker, this month we celebrate the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta. It is a document that reminds us of the long and rich tradition of individual freedoms and legal rights which we enjoy. That tradition stretches back to the 13th century in Britain, not just back to 1840. Indeed, the Magna Carta itself was indebted to the earlier coronation charter of Henry I in 1100, a charter which was then ignored for a century. The Magna Carta itself was ignored and belittled initially. It was even annulled by Pope Innocent III. I can make it longer. But with much struggle, eventually achieved traction, acquired a heritage and symbolic force. Magna Carta, which in its Latin meanings, means Great Charter, paved the road to modern democracy. It could be thought of as representing the seed from which have grown many of the principles on which our democracy is based. Meeting in June 1215, feudal barons gathered outside London to define the limit of the powers of King John, forcing him to affix his seal to the Charter. This Charter was narrow in scope. It concerned the medieval relationship between the monarch and the barons, rather than the rights of ordinary people at that time. But over time, that principle was extended. It planted the seed of an idea, which was extended and then generalised. Ultimately, and with great struggle, because rulers do not easily give up their powers, it granted every citizen individual freedoms, laying the foundation for constitutional rights and for this House and our Parliament.
The Honourable Chris Finlayson.
Mr. Speaker, I've drawn the short straw to respond. Yesterday was the 800th anniversary of the sealing of Magna Carta, and I say for Mr. Robertson's benefit, it was sealed, not signed. And we had a function in the Grand Hall attended by you, Mr. Speaker, the Leader of the Opposition, Mr. Parker, Dr. Graham, and several other members of Parliament. In my speech, I mentioned the comments of UK Supreme Court Judge Lord Sumption, who began his recent address to the Friends of the British Library by saying, quote, "It's impossible to say anything new about Magna Carta unless you say something mad. In fact, even if you say something mad, the likelihood is that it will have been said before, probably quite recently." So I look forward to Mr. Peter's contribution. His comments reflect two opposing points. First, that the role of Magna Carta is frequently misunderstood, but second, that its role is of such importance that few documents have been more influential to countries like our own. What we can say for certain is that Magna Carta has come to symbolise the enduring values and principles that guide our society today, values such as freedom of religion, the right to justice and human rights.
The Honourable David Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I add to the acclamation that's been given to the Great Charter, which is the translation of the word Magna Carta. It means the Great Charter. I do think the words that the Attorney-General just read out, which are the only paragraph that remains in our law, which was put into the Imperial Laws Application Act 1988, means that this clause does remain in place, which is, as the effect of which is, that all men and women remain equal before the law and due process shall apply. And I think the words are worthy of reading again. I know the minister's just read them out, or the attorney. But no free man shall be taken or imprisoned or be deceased of his freehold or liberties or free customs or be outlawed or exiled or otherwise destroyed, nor will we not pass upon him nor condemn him by any lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land. We will sell to no man, we will not deny or defer to any other man justice or right. Now, sir, even those words have been largely modified by the particular statutes that we have in New Zealand that guarantee justice to people. And I think really that what we're left with is what another great Australian jurist, Dennis DeNuto, said to the High Court of Australia. It's in the vibe of the thing. And it really is. It really is. It is an important and enduring vibe of the thing. And indeed, I can remember in this House Magna Carta being referred to in respect of the claims of injustice caused by the foreshore and seabed legislation, first iteration. So it is a document that has an enduring legal and political legacy, and it seems to me, Mr. Speaker, that it stands alongside the Treaty of Waitangi in New Zealand, and that whilst not all parts of it are directly in our law, and it's the same of the Treaty of Waitangi, it's not part of our statute, it does have an enduring political and legal influence upon our country, and in both the case of the Magna Carta and the Treaty of Waitangi, that is a good thing.
Eugenie Sage.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Green Party supports the recognition of the 800th anniversary of the sealing of the Magna Carta in that meadow, the Runnymede, beside the Thames River. But we recognise Te Tiriti o Waitangi as our most important constitutional document.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
There's nothing like envy. Of course, today some would say that we have some people in this House, one with the name of John, the other with the name of Chris, who assume kingly powers. It is also without a hint of irony that the motion is in the name of one David Seymour, an earnest young fellow who lavishes praise on a document that is the oldest legislation on our statute books. Magna Carta inspired those who fought in the English Civil War to the suffragettes. Yet he has his seat due to political largesse in a constitutional rot. And for my friend Mr. Finlayson's benefit, let us remind the House and the public of this country that it is he and the National Party's Judicature Modernisation Bill currently before the House, which deletes the declaration as to parliamentary sovereignty and the rule of law, which is in the Supreme Court Act of 2003. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just to put things in legal perspective for the doyen of the legal fraternity in this House and apparently around the whole Commonwealth. Now, although it is a document signed in medieval England between the barons and the king, it is no exaggeration to suggest that Magna Carta forms a foundation stone of the freedoms and liberties we now enjoy in New Zealand. It's one of the most important documents in history as it establishes the principle, as others said, that no one is above the rule of law. Even, might I add, across the House, the rulers. The Charter gave individuals the right to justice and the right to a fair trial. The ideas rooted in Magna Carta have formed the basis of freedoms and liberties we now enjoy in our modern democracy. Now, New Zealand First is a political party. Now, we only get a bit tremorous when we see what members over there are capable of doing with this magnificent document. Exactly. Yeah. New Zealand First is a political party committed to a strong and dynamic democracy in New Zealand. We are for vigilance and standing against any changes that undermine or weaken our democracy. And we urge all New Zealanders to value our democracy and to be vigilant in safeguarding our democratic heritage.
Speaker.
Madam Fox.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I didn't draw the short straw. I lost the paper, rock, scissors. But I stand with the House to commemorate the 800th anniversary of the granting of the Magna Carta in 1215, the significant document that occurred 800 years ago as of yesterday. 800 years have passed since the granting of the Magna Carta and the brokered peace between King John and the rebel barons. 800 years have passed since the first steps towards a commitment to basic human rights first provided for and recognised by the Crown. Although 800 years later, we know there are still improvements to be made in ensuring the word and rule of law is applied equally and indiscriminately and is treated with the greatness and respect. The Magna Carta was the result of a rebellion against arbitrary abuse of authority by the monarch. Many might point to the establishment of the Māori Party as an act of rebellion in being established to represent the power of the people under which we represent. The product of this stand is significant. It paved the way for other fundamental texts, such as the writ of habeas corpus, the US Constitution, the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and even our very own treaty. The Magna Carta sought to limit the unbridled power of King John, and we recognise that it's the foundation of our law, but we think that we should also recognise the place of the treaty in our law. And that quote that Mr. Finlayson has already articulated, I'll repeat for the benefit of the House. No free man shall be seized or imprisoned or stripped of his rights or possessions or outlawed or exiled or deprived of his standing in any way, nor will we proceed with force against him or send others to do so, except by the lawful judgment of his equals or by the law of the land. And I want to point to a few pieces of legislation that stood in this land. The Suppression of Rebellion Act, the Tohunga Suppression Act, and the Native Schools Act. Today we find contemporary examples of inequality, such as the establishment of the Māori seat, first done so to ring-fence the Māori vote. In fact, in this House, you can get rid of a Māori seat by 50% of the vote, but for any other seat, it requires 75%. That in itself needs to be addressed in the interests of equality. Through the reflection of that quote that I used before, many issues have yet to be resolved. How do we recognise the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi, water rights, Ngāti Whātua, Ōrākei, rights of first refusal? How do we honour the Treaty of Waitangi that so that there is not a circumvention of our law? The quote is especially fitting when we consider these things alongside the treaty, and I think the last part is important, to no one deny or delay the rights of justice. And so I stand proudly to represent the Māori Party in calling for a recognition of the principles and the spirit of the Magna Carta 800 years later. Kia ora.
Thank you. The question is, the motion be agreed to. Those of that opinion will say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, no. The ayes have it.
The Speaker, David Carter, ending that debate on the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta. More online at parliamenttoday.co.nz. I'm Rhys Lyon and I'll be back with Tom Frewen and another report from Parliament at the same time next week.